Rose Aguilar, and this is your call. In their new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy, today's guest, Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, and the Reverend William Barber, write that there are 40 million more poor white people than black people. But most Americans think of poverty, along with issues like welfare, unemployment, and food stamps, as solely a black problem. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and the Reverend William Barber believe that addressing white poverty might provide the key to mitigating racism and bringing together tens of millions of working class and impoverished Americans to demand desperately needed change in this country. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is founder of the School for Conversion, an organization that works for communities that unlearn habits of social division. He's also assistant director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is featured in Bad Faith, a new documentary that reveals how Christian nationalists have succeeded in taking over the Republican Party. We did a show about Bad Faith last month, and you can find it at kalw.org, click on news, and find Your Call's past shows. Unfortunately, the Reverend William Barber could not join us today, but we'll hopefully have him on a future show, and we are very glad to have Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove with us. Hi, Jonathan. Thank you so much for your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Well, thank you, Rose. It's good to be with you.
Well, it's great to have you. It was so interesting to learn about some of your story in the documentary Bad Faith, and then you have an interesting chapter about your grandmothers in the new book White Poverty. Can you first tell us a bit about your work, how you got to this place, and then how you met the Reverend William Barber?
Sure can. So I grew up in the foothills of North Carolina's mountains. That's Appalachia. That's hillbilly country. And my people have been there for as long as anybody can remember. I grew up there in the 1980s and 90s and was raised in the Baptist church. And I was an earnest kid who wanted to do all that I could for Jesus. And I thought at that time, because of the local culture, that that meant I should become president of the United States. I was very much caught up in the formation programs of the religious right at the time. But I made it to Washington, D.C. and paged for Senator Strom Thurmond, the one-time Dixiecrat candidate for president, but someone who was instrumental in bringing Southern Democrats into the Republican Party in the 20th century. And get kind of being up close and witnessing what was actually being done in the name of the language that was usually used then was traditional values and biblical values. I found there to be a tension between what I had learned in Sunday school, the things that Jesus actually said, and what people were doing in Jesus' name. So as a teenager, I became disillusioned with this sort of merging of our faith with an extreme political agenda, but I didn't know any other way to be Christian in public. And I went back to North Carolina, where I was from, and ended up meeting Reverend Barber. And he was just at an event that the governor's office hosted. I think he was supposed to give a motivational speech, but his vision was so rooted in, you know, the prophetic texts of scripture that I could tell he was a preacher. And I said, I wanted to learn from him. I've been learning from him ever since. So it was a real gift to write this book together.
It's such an interesting background, Jonathan. And I'm sure that that really shapes how you see this political moment with Donald Trump now running the Republican Party, choosing J.D. Vance as his running mate. And then, of course, President Biden stepping down and endorsing Vice President Kamala Harris, who is almost certain to become the nominee. Can you talk more about this political moment? I mean, I know it's a big question, but how does your past, being raised in the Baptist church and then co-writing a book with the Reverend William Barber, one of the leaders of the Poor People's Campaign, how has all of that shaped how you see this political moment?
Well, what we call today the MAGA movement, it grew out of all of that culture that was being created as I was growing up. I think this is a big misunderstanding of our political moment in a lot of mainstream coverage. People act like Donald Trump has done something new. If you were in any of the communities that were targeted by this campaign, it started in the late 70s and has been a pretty consistent effort ever since. It's an effort to merge a distortion of Christian faith with a very libertarian economic vision, and to sort of present that as populism. And that's what I came up around. It's what has, you know, created so many of what we call red counties. But as a matter of fact, these places are more diverse than they look like on the outside. And people in these places understand that they've really been sold out by people like J.D. Vance. I mean, J.D. Vance built his career on being a hillbilly whisperer. You know, he published this memoir when he was out in Silicon Valley, you know, working as a venture capitalist, and, you know, claimed to explain the so-called economic anxiety that had driven people towards Trump. Well, let's be clear. There is a lot of economic hardship in this country, not just in Appalachia, but in every community. That hardship has been driven by the, you know, neoliberal economics that has made the corporations extremely wealthy and has made, you know, most people have a hard time getting by in this country right now. So that has affected all of our communities, but places like where I'm from have been sold this this very thin philosophy that merges our faith and our traditional cultures with this extreme economic and political vision. And what we have realized is that this makes the country very vulnerable. So we wanted to write about white poverty because it's really a window into understanding how people have been pitted against one another by, you know, this strategy. It's 40 years of this so-called Southern strategy that really targeted not just the South, but also the suburbs and the Sun Belt across the western part of the United States, and has tried to use these cultural wedge issues to pit white people against their immigrant neighbors, their black neighbors, their brown neighbors, their gay neighbors, their, you know, younger neighbors. I mean, it's an extremely divisive movement. And we think, we've actually seen in practice, that when poor white folks are able to come together and work together with others around building an economy that works for everyone, there's an incredible potential for changing the political conversation there.
And this is what you all do so well with the Poor People's Campaign. And you've got chapters in every state across the country. And people are really challenging what you just laid out there. So let's dive in and talk about what you all found. I mean, one of the biggest facts that you share in this book is that there are 40 million more poor white people than black people. But most Americans think of poverty, along with issues like welfare, unemployment, and food stamps, as solely a black problem. And, you know, this is repeated mostly, I mean, across the media for sure, but daily in conservative media. So can you talk about why you thought this was so important to emphasize? I mean, this is on the publicity information for the book, White Poverty, that there are 40 million more poor white people than black people.
Well, that's right. And to get there, you have to actually count poverty as it is. So what we first do in the book is we look at why we don't recognize, by and large, in the United States, that we have a crisis of poverty. I mean, this is not on the news most days. And you have to ask why, if you compare U.S. poverty to other, you know, countries like ours around the world. We have 295,000 people a year, that's 800 people a day, who die in this country from being poor. When we had that many people dying from a virus, we called it a pandemic. But that's been the reality of poverty in this country now for some time. That is the fourth leading cause of death in this country. And
Jonathan, sorry to interrupt you. Can you elaborate on that a bit? Because you're right. We do not hear this. And some people may have stopped in their tracks to hear that. 800 people die every day in this country from poverty?
It's true. I mean, David Brady out of University of California at Riverside published the study, and we cited in the book. I mean, we got a little bit of coverage when it came out. This study came out just a couple years ago, but yeah, we've hidden this poverty somehow from our public discussion, and so that's kind of the first question we try to address is, you know, why don't we see this crisis that is really affecting every community in the country? I mean, this is another stat most people don't know, is that there's not a single county in the United States where someone who is working full-time at minimum wage can afford to rent a two-bedroom apartment. Mm. Now, a lot of people understand that the cost of housing has gone up, you know, that it's that they feel pinched by their rent or their mortgage payments. A lot of people feel pinched who own places just by their tax payments these days. But the reality is, if you are a low-wage worker, there's nowhere in the country where you can live. So this isn't just, you know, poor communities versus wealthy community. This is everywhere. So when you realize that this is a crisis, and it's a crisis that's largely going unaddressed, at least, you know, in any kind of serious public discussion, the question becomes why. And we think the answer is that poverty has been racialized, that for about 40 years since the, you know, end of the civil rights movement, there was a shift in American politics, a shift away from trying to pit people against one another in terms of race explicitly, because that became politically incorrect after the civil rights movement, toward using these cultural wedge issues and other issues to try to keep people divided. And that has included a racialization of poverty, so that the images we see of poverty, images in the media, I mean, even sometimes, you know, images that we reproduce in you know, nonprofit groups and other groups that are trying to fight poverty. We've had this image of poverty being a black and brown issue. And most white folks don't think of themselves as poor. But when we went back and looked at the data on poverty and economic hardship in this country, what some scholars technically call people who are low income, we found that there were 140 million people who, by the technical definition, are a $500 emergency away from economic ruin. That's 43% of the country. That's an incredibly large amount of people. And what we realize is that we aren't able to talk about that, and we aren't able to build a coalition of people who recognize that these issues impact them because of these divisive racial politics that really rely on myths that have been used throughout American history to divide people.
We have an email from Eileen who says, can you be more specific? Are we talking about, you know, not having health care? And I'm just looking at the study that came out from the University of California, Riverside, last year. It found that only heart disease, cancer, and smoking were associated with a greater number of deaths than poverty. Obesity, diabetes, drug overdoses, suicides, firearms, and homicides, among other common causes of death, were less lethal than poverty. David Bradley says, he's the study's lead author, poverty silently killed 10 times as many people as all homicides in 2019, and yet they get vastly more attention. They found that because certain ethnic and racial minority groups are far more likely to be in poverty, our estimates can improve the understanding of ethnic and racial inequalities in life expectancy. Deaths are associated with a very great economic cost. Can you talk more about this? Can you just be more detailed about is causing so many people to die daily from poverty?
So I talked to David after the study came out, and I asked him, I said, why did you decide to do this study? And he said that it was specifically because he kept seeing that we had a national conversation every time there was a mass shooting about guns. And, you know, I mean, it is devastating how many people die from gun violence in this country. And the mass shootings are just a small portion of that. You know, it's most people who die by gun violence die in sort of smaller incidents. Nevertheless, you know, that number, as you just noted, is nothing compared to the number of people who die from poverty. And so David just kind of on a hunch asks this question, you know, which is a larger contributing factor to unnecessary deaths in the United States, and came up with this number, 295,000 people dying from poverty. So what does that mean? Well, the data that they use means that, you know, people are chronically living, you know, below the income that they need to meet their basic necessities. And you can then kind of extrapolate from that, well, that does mean that they don't have access to the healthcare they need. It probably means that they also don't have, you know, access to healthy foods. It also means that they, you know, are not in stable living conditions. When people think about poverty, they often imagine, you know, the image of someone who is obviously unhoused on the streets, or, you know, the people they've seen in the sort of most extreme and dire circumstances in public life. But when you talk about this 140 million people, we're talking about a lot of people who go to work every day, but at the end of the day have nowhere to go home. You know, they sleep in their car in a Walmart parking lot. We're talking about, you know, people who work, but can't afford health insurance for their families. We're talking about, you know, people who have to work sometimes two and three jobs, you know, the public school teacher who drives, you know, for Uber or Lyft in the evening just to try to make enough money to pay their rent. This is the economic reality that, is contributing to these, dramatic health outcomes. And so poverty looks a lot more like most Americans' lives than most people think.
And all of this results in a much lower life expectancy. That's what the study also focuses on. On today's Your Call, we are spending the hour with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. He co-wrote the book White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy, with the Reverend William Barber, who is one of the leaders of the Poor People's Campaign. They write that there are 40 million more white people than black people, but most Americans don't know that. They think of poverty as solely a black problem. They believe that addressing white poverty might provide the key to mitigating racism and bringing together tens of millions of working class and impoverished people to demand desperately needed change in this country. Let's talk more about the kind of the overall argument that you both make in the book. In the preface, the Reverend Barber writes, "The myths that blame black people for their poverty and call white people trash when they experience the same begin to unravel when we face the reality that there are more than twice as many poor white people as there are poor and low-income black people. Politicians sometimes call poor white folks working class or those aspiring to the middle class, but when we count them with all the other poor Americans, we can see that poverty is the cancer consuming our common life. Yes, racism persists, making rates of poverty higher in communities of color, but the same lie that blames black people for their poverty prevents us from seeing the pain of poor families who've been offered little more than whiteness and angry tweets to sustain them in an economy where the cost of housing, healthcare, education, and transportation have skyrocketed while wages have stagnated for almost all Americans." So can you talk more about this, Jonathan? I mean, you and the Reverend Barber really spend a lot of time talking about how the politicians tell white people that it's a black person's fault that they lost their good union job, or that it's the immigrant's fault that they lost their job, and yet at the same time they're cutting their services.
Yeah, that's right. And this is the long history of both where race came from and how racism has worked in American society. So we want to be clear, we're not turning away from race to economics by talking about white poverty. We're actually saying, if you look closely at this, you can see the real way that racism has hurt all of us. So we go back to the beginning of the American story. We look at the Virginia colony and look at the ways that, you know, race as we understand it today, you know, as an identity marker that differentiates white people from black people, that emerged in order to really pit the plantation workers of that emerging plantation economy against one another. I mean, in the beginning of the Virginia colony, the lived experience of, you know, people who had come from Africa and people who had come from Europe as indentured servants was fairly similar. And there's lots of history there of, you know, people living relatively similar lives and actually, you know, forming social bonds and, you know, ways of working together that became threatening to the established authorities at that time. And so, you know, within the code of the Virginia Assembly, they began to develop definitions of race in order to separate, you know, black workers from white workers. You can, you know, fast forward there through U.S. history, and at critical moments when the country has changed in order to become more just for more people, it has been because, you know, folks have come together across those lines. That's the story of Reconstruction after the Civil War. And I mean, I remember well when Reverend Barber first started teaching me this history in North Carolina. I had grown up, you know, in North Carolina, learned a lot about the Civil War. I mean, white folks love to talk about the Civil War in North Carolina, but never heard the history of Reconstruction when, you know, my ancestors, really poor working white folks from the western part of the state, joined the Populist Party, and that Populist Party joined with recently, you know, enfranchised black Republicans at that time, and formed what was called the Fusion Party in North Carolina. There were fusion parties across the South, and they rewrote constitutions that, you know, allowed these states to come back into the Union during Reconstruction. And those constitutions, you know, did things like guaranteeing public education to all people. I mean, my people didn't have access to public education before that. I went with my white family, three generations of my white family, several years ago, up to Norfolk, Virginia, and we sat under the Freedom Tree. They still have a tree there where the recently, the people who had escaped from slavery during the Civil War made it out to Norfolk, and the Union Army controlled the fort there, so they were free. And they were recruited to fight for the Union Army. Those men said that they would fight if the United States would commit to educating their children. And so the first, you know, public schools for African-American children in Virginia started under those trees there. My family stood under there and thought about how those people, when they gained political power, actually fought for people like us to have education. That is the story of fusion politics in this country. That is what has expanded democracy throughout our history. But we are often sold the lie that if black people have something, it's going to take away from white people. That's been the myth. And those myths are what we're trying to both narrate and dispel in this book in order to tell the stories of fusion politics that are happening today. And they are many.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we're speaking with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove, founder of the School for Conversion, an organization that works for communities that unlearn habits of social division. We'll talk more about that after a break. He's also assistant director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove co-wrote the new book with Reverend William Barber, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. If you'd like to find our past shows, go over to KALW.org, click on News, and then Your Call. Today, we're spending the hour with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. We're talking about the new book he co-wrote with the Reverend William Barber, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Jonathan is Assistant Director of the Center for Public Theology and Public Policy at Yale Divinity School. He's also founder of the School for Conversion. This is an organization that works for communities that unlearn habits of social division. Jonathan, this is so interesting. Just the name of the school is interesting, School for Conversion. And to think that you work for communities that unlearn habits of social division, can you tell us more about this? How did you come to found this group? And tell us more about what you all do.
Well, so I'm a Christian. I grew up in the church and I've remained in the church. I will say it helped me a lot to meet black Christians in the South because they had a very different way of reading the Bible. And I'm still a minister in the Black Baptist church tradition. But this language that has been so distorted and misused by the extremists who claim my faith, I try to claim it back whenever I get a chance. So conversion is one of those words. I mean, conversion gets used in terrible ways, you know, to talk about, you know, forcing people to believe something, to talk about, you know, conversion therapy, you know, trying to change gay folks and this sort of stuff. That's not what we mean at all. The root of that word in the Greek of the New Testament is metanoia. It means the transformation of your mind. And it occurs to me, just based on my own experience, that before anything else could happen in my life, my mind had to be transformed. That's the story I was telling earlier about my encounter with Reverend Barber when I was a teenager. So that's the kind of thing that we've been trying to facilitate for people within church communities that have been targeted by this, you know, divisive extremism for decades now. We try to give people experiences where they can sit, you know, across the circle, across the table with people who've lived very different experiences, hear their stories, share their own stories, and imagine, you know, how life could be different if we shared life together. So that's the kind of conversion that we've tried to talk about.
Can you give us some examples that stand out for you? I'm sure there are so many. You have some video examples on your website about friendships that have reshaped people's lives. You also do a 21st century freedom ride, taking people to various sites that explore the history of the civil rights movement. So can you give us some examples?
Well, sure. I mean, in this book, White Poverty, we tell stories about, you know, how groups that are coming together today in many ways have learned from and echo groups that have come together throughout Southern history. So we've done that over the years as a kind of lived experience on a bus, you know, people who are, you know, young white folks and young black folks and young immigrants. We worked a lot with the folks who called themselves Dreamers, you know, about a decade ago when they were trying to figure out, you know, how do you live in this society if you grew up like everybody else, but now they say you're undocumented. So we would take bus trips together and we would have people talk about the issues that were facing them in their lives today. But then we would, you know, stop in, Raleigh, North Carolina and talk about how the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee was black and white students who came together in 1960 and, you know, formed a direct action nonviolence group that really, you know, led much of the civil rights movement in the 60s by taking the freedom rides and doing the sit-ins at the lunch counters and those kind of things. So that's one example of the kind of thing we've done. We also developed a program to have classes inside of prisons. I mean, a lot of people, you know, sort of draw the parallel between the segregation of the mid-20th century that is remembered as Jim Crow and the new Jim Crow of mass incarceration. I mean, that's kind of a big idea, but we tried to create a context where that could become real for people by saying, you know, you can take a class. You got to come once a week. It's a class inside of a prison, and half of the students in that class are going to be people who are incarcerated. So folks on the inside wanted access to education. People on the outside were interested in this way of sort of taking a course that they might take on a college campus, but having the experience of going through the course with people who are incarcerated. And, you know, we did spiritual memoir. We did, you know, classes on, various social topics. We did history classes. We, you know, had a professor who taught Gandhi and the history of India and did that inside of prisons. But in that context, what we found is that, you know, people processing the material together and sharing about their own lives was a transformational experience. And so we ran that program for a decade and then handed it off to Duke Divinity School that continues to run it today. So we've done programs like that. The notion of a surprising friendship is just to bring people together across these divisions that have been intentionally cultivated by the movement that I was talking about earlier. These cultural wedge issues, you know, to pit black against white, to pit, you know, gay against straight, to pit so-called liberals against conservatives. Bring people together, give them a chance to talk about the real issues that impact their lives across those lines. And we've seen that you know, what I was talking about earlier is fusion politics can really be manifest in, you know, daily life in fusion friendships and people really knowing one another across these divides and realizing that we have a lot more in common than we've been taught to believe.
You know, to that point, we're going to get to calls in just a minute, but to that point, what are your thoughts about what we have seen from so many poor white people across the country who are supporting Donald Trump? It is very easy to assume that a lot of these people are racist, given what comes out of Donald Trump's mouth. Given that you work with these people, you try to reach these people. Yeah. What are your thoughts on that? How should we be thinking about that?
Well, it's absolutely true that this movement that I've been describing has dramatically impacted the culture in many parts of the country. And, you know, those places do have a majority of the people who vote for Donald Trump right now. And the culture of that movement is such that you know, they're very loud and fly flags and these sort of things. But what we argue in the book is that it's something that most Americans don't realize, that most poor people have never supported Donald Trump. When he ran against, you know, Clinton in 2016, she beat him by 9 points on people who made less than $50,000 a year. When he ran against Biden in 2020, Biden beat him by 14 points. So the myth that, you know, poor people have supported Trump, that his movement is some kind of genuine populism, just isn't true. He could not have won without the majority support of people who make more than $150,000 a year. But it is the case that, you know, white folks poor white folks who live in places that have been just hounded by this culture of division, they have no other local political culture to be part of. And what we've learned going to these places is that it's not so much that a majority of the local people support that as it is that many people have just dropped out of participating. I mean, there are so-called red counties in this country where even in a presidential election year, you don't get 40% turnout anymore. And so when you go to those places and you get people to talk about what actually matters to them, the policies that they would support are progressive policies. Policies like, you know, raising wages, making sure people have health care, you know, guaranteeing education for these folks and their children, you know, not just the K-12 education, but, you know, that people can do the kind of trade or college education they need to get good jobs. Those are policies that actually excite people, and people say they would get involved in politics. They would vote for somebody if they came and told them that was what they were going to champion. So we really believe that we're at a moment when mobilizing poor people, black, white, and brown, has the potential to transform the political conversation in this country.
This is really important. In the chapter, Poor People Are the New Swing Voters, in your new book, White Poverty, you write, if poor people voted at levels similar to their higher income neighbors, their voting power could not only flip the swing states Trump won across the Rust Belt. According to Hartley's analysis, they could crack the solid South that Republicans have counted on for decades by flipping North Carolina, Georgia, Florida, Mississippi, Texas, and Arizona. As you say, the key is building a movement that can persuade political candidates to speak directly to this potential electorate, championing an agenda that would improve the lot of most Americans. So according to Columbia University, 34 million poor people did not vote in 2016. I mean, this That's right. A huge block. So can you talk more about this? Because it's not just Republicans. I mean, we know that the policies on economic issues, I mean, we can talk about this for hours, but it's not just Republicans that do not talk to poor people. I mean, Look at what Democrats have done with NAFTA and so many other policies. So given that we're talking about such a huge amount of people, why do you think these issues don't get more attention?
Well, you know, unfortunately, both of our political parties have capitulated too much to the corporate donors who have benefited so much from policies that have extracted the nation's wealth from, you know, this 43% of people who are living in poverty, and have made the wealthiest Americans and the corporations wealthier than they have ever been at any point in world history. So that's the reality that we're facing. It is absolutely true that, you know, both parties have ignored the poor. It's not true that both parties are the same, however. So I think what's really important is that we build a movement that can challenge politicians to speak directly to poor people. And that's what the Poor People's Campaign has been doing. And we narrate in the book real examples of where that's made a huge difference. There was a gubernatorial election in Kentucky in 2019 where, you know, there was a Trump-backed extremist who was in office. He was an incumbent. He was running for reelection. He was in, you know, a so-called red state, a place where, you know, somebody – you know, the people call this MAGA country. They call it, you know, places that just, you know, where Democrats can't win. But Bashir, who's now being considered as a potential, you know, vice president for Harris, he went to the whole state. He went out into eastern Kentucky, you know, places where my people are from, up in the mountains. And he talked to people about, you know, issues that impact their everyday life. And he did talk about it in terms of, you know, liberal versus conservative. He talked about it as this is language we've tried to use in our campaign. This is what's morally right. Like it's right to make sure everybody has the basic things they need in a society that has this much wealth. And what was fascinating when we looked at the numbers there is that, you know, those so-called red counties, they didn't completely flip blue in eastern Kentucky, but a lot more people turned out to vote for him than had ever turned out to vote for Democrats in the past. And in the end, in the statewide race, it was that increased turnout in eastern Kentucky that made the difference for him. So when politicians speak directly to these issues, we can turn out people who are desperate to hear somebody speak to the things that impact their lives. I think Biden did this in 2020. He spoke to an event that the Poor People's Campaign organized. He said that he was going to make ending poverty a theory of change in his administration. He embraced policies like raising the minimum wage, like restoring voting rights across the board for everyone, and certainly was not able to get, you know, everything that he embraced in the platform through the Congress. But nevertheless, our analysis afterwards was that 7 million more low-income voters, infrequent low-income voters, turned out in 2020 than had turned out 4 years earlier. And that certainly made a huge difference in those swing states that he won by pretty narrow margins. So we're at a moment when, you know, states are several of the so-called swing states are going to be won by, you know, 10, 20, 50,000 votes statewide. In some of these states, we have as many as 1 million or 1.5 million low-income voters who are registered to vote but who did not vote in the last election. We think campaigns reaching out directly to those people and explaining to them how government can work for them is critically important, not only in terms of you know, turnout for one particular election, but in terms of reviving a democracy that we have pretty wide consensus is under threat in this country.
Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove and the Reverend William Barber wrote the new book, White Poverty, How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy. Let's take two callers who've been waiting patiently, and then we will get Jonathan to respond. Let's go to Pat in Pacifica. Hi, Pat.
Oh, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, great. It's really great to thank you, Jonathan, for all of your work. I met William Barber some years ago at the Poor People's Campaign in D.C. And the question I had for you was, I've been doing this on my own radio show, you know, on KXSF. It's Mega Trends every Wednesday, and I've been talking about the national healthcare system. So the question I wanted to ask you, given everything that you have said, how do you think that a national healthcare system would impact everything that you've been talking about, the 140 million people who are less than $500 away from a crisis, the 295,000 people a year that die as a result of poverty? What impact, given all the equity issues that are embedded in the national healthcare system, do you think would change things radically? If you could please go into detail about that, I'd be very much appreciative.
Well, thank you for the call. So since you asked a specific question, we'll get Jonathan to respond. And we're planning to do a number of shows about Kamala Harris and where she stands on specific issues. This piece just came out about her healthcare plans. And it's important to remember that she did sign on to the Medicare for All Act of 2019, which was led by Senator Bernie Sanders. So what are your thoughts on this, Jonathan?
Well, the Poor People's Campaign is committed to an agenda that includes, you know, a national plan to guarantee everyone access to health care. Now, as I'm sure you all know and your listeners know, too, there's been a long-term debate in this country about the best ways to get there. And, you know, that's going to be a kind of coalition-building effort. But I do think within the Democratic Party, there have been huge strides in recent years towards understanding that, you know, as the name Medicare for All suggests, that, you know, we do have universal health care for people over a certain age in this country. And so there are ideas that we could build on. And I think that's a wise place to begin. I think it'll be, you know, a political conversation that will take time. But what's critical, what's absolutely critical, is that we have a base of people that can elect majorities in both the House, the Senate, and with support in the White House that is committed to doing that and to making it happen. That's the critical thing in an election year. And so I think building as broad a coalition as we can that's committed to making sure everyone in this country has access to good quality health care is a priority for, you know, any movement that is going to address poverty.
And according to NBC, Kamala Harris would also be likely to work with Congress to extend Medicaid coverage in the 10 Republican-controlled states that have refused to expand it. I mean, this hurts poor and low-income people so hard. And she could carry on Senator Sanders' attempts to expand Medicare to cover dental, vision, and hearing benefits for seniors. I mean, this one, Jonathan, is just huge. The fact that Medicare...
Let me just say real quickly on this one. I mean, you know, expanding Medicaid is one step toward, but, you know, it's been possible since the ACA. And I think that there's been terrible messaging in terms of how this has impacted poor white folks. So we tell a story in the book about how North Carolina, where both Reverend Barber and I are from, refused to expand Medicaid after the ACA was passed. And what that meant, because of, you know, part of the negotiations of the ACA was that rural health care was going to be sustained through Medicaid payments. And so rural hospitals began to close, not only in North Carolina, but across this country. We've lost hundreds over the last decade. And when one closed in North Carolina, we actually had a Republican governor reach out and ask for help because he said none of his fellow Republicans in the state house would help. Our movement joined with him in a campaign to try to save the hospital down there. We weren't able to save that hospital because we couldn't get the funding that the Republicans had blocked at the state level. And the first person to die in that case was a white woman, who got to the, you know, to the place where she could have gotten emergency care and was having a heart attack, and instead had to wait for a helicopter to fly from the closest medical center. She died because, you know, they there was not a hospital within that golden hour that so many people need in order to survive that sort of thing. And so, you know, we did the analysis and we said, you know, to white folks across rural North Carolina that, you know, if they had expanded Medicaid, 500,000 people would have had access to health care the next day. And 350,000 of them were white. But the people who refused to expand it called it Obamacare, racialized it, said that it was going to, you know, steal from taxpayers and give to black folks. And that's what kept all those white people from not getting access to health care. It's what killed that Sister Portia Gibbs. So we tell her story and the story of the movement there that included Republicans and Democrats, white folks and black folks coming together to say, we need a different kind of political conversation about what everyday people need to survive in this country.
Mm. It's a devastating story, and it's connected to what Lorna writes in. Can you please ask your guest to explain his statements that neoliberal economics are responsible for white poverty? I get that NAFTA under Clinton offshored many jobs, but what about the consistent Republican supplication to the rich and corporate powers in the form of the Bush tax cuts, then the Trump tax cuts, and Trump wants more tax cuts for the rich? This is so important, Lorna. There's a new study out, and I'm reading this from Truth Out. Americans for Tax Fairness reported that U.S. billionaires have doubled their wealth since 2017 Trump tax overhaul. Billionaires now control one out of every $25 of American wealth. So, Jonathan, we are seeing poor people in the states that you just talked about, the Republican states that are not expanding Medicare, dying, and yet these same politicians are backing these tax cuts for the ultra wealthy.
Yeah. And I'll just apologize if I confused with my language, but when I say neoliberalism, I'm describing all of that. Mm-hmm. Neoliberalism is the economic movement that, beginning, you know, in the latter part of the 20th century, started to say that freedom, economic freedom, means corporations being able to do whatever they want to. And that has been embraced, by Republicans and Democrats in the United States for far too long. And yes, it absolutely is the root cause of the, dramatic wealth accumulation that's happened, among the wealthiest in this country. And the fact that, you know, real wages have stagnated for almost everyone when we looked at the numbers in, because of the decimation of unions in places like, you know, Appalachia, where co-workers had unions in many parts of the Rust Belt and other things. It has actually caused real wages for white men to decrease. So that's, you know, the real, consequence that everyday people have had to face because of these policies that have said, if you give the companies more, that will grow the economy. Well, it might, you know, by certain economic measures, it might grow GDP. It might grow, you know, returns for people who have investments in the stock market. It has not grown the capacity of everyday people to afford the things that they need. And that, we believe, is why we need a fundamental shift in the conversation about economics in this country.
Thank you for the email, Lorna. Jonathan, this hour has just flown by. We have a couple minutes left. A few more stats you share in the book. There were 140 million people nationally who were poor or low income before COVID. 52 million workers in this country make less than $15 an hour. That is 32% of the country's total workforce. Of course, the minimum wage has not been raised since 2009. You all point out that a living wage bill did pass the House, but in the Senate, 8 Democrats, every Republican voted against it. These are massive numbers, Jonathan. What else can people do to ensure that these issues get the attention they deserve in this 24/7 news cycle?
Well, let me say two things. One is that all of those numbers were true in 2020, and it's important to recognize that a commitment to raise the floor by this administration over the past 3.5 years has made a real difference. So no, the promise that Democrats made in 2020 to pass a you know, across the board minimum wage for all workers in the United States at $15 an hour, that did not happen. However, Biden's administration did raise the federal minimum wage to 15, and their administration did stand with unions at a moment when unions have had a huge surge in both activism and participation that has challenged companies to share more of their earnings with their workers. So as you just cited, you know, 32% of workers just 3.5 years ago were making less than $15 an hour. Today, it's only 13%. Now, if you had asked me if we could make up, you know, that much of a difference in just 3.5 years in 2020, I would have said no. Even you know, with legislation getting through, I didn't see it moving that quickly. But that has been possible. So I think it's important to remember, while we have not gotten everything that we want, that we have seen real and significant change just in the last 3.5 years. What can people do now? Well, what we're saying is that we have to build a movement that both compels politicians to talk about these issues and convinces poor people of their power in this election. So if just 15% of the low-income people who did not turn out in the last election could be persuaded to turn out in this election, they have the power to swing every single so-called swing state and some that aren't even considered swing states in this country. This could change the Electoral College map. This could change all of the assumptions about what the makeup of the Senate and the House is going to be. It could change the conversation about what is politically possible in this country. The Poor People's Campaign has committed to reach out through our state chapters to 15 million low-income voters. That's half of the low-income voters who did not participate last time in this election. You can join that campaign by going to poorpeoplescampaign.org if you'd like to be part of it.
Well, thank you. And thank you for the correction. We did not see that updated number, which is incredible. 13% of workers earn less than $15 an hour. 2 years ago, that number was 31%. Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove is co-founder of the book White Poverty. Thank you so much for joining us, Jonathan. We'd love to have you back. And thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.